Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 715, Interview with Russ Baker. This is being recorded on June 6th of the year 2010. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves the author of the formidable and consummately important book, Family of Secrets, subtitled The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Russ Baker, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Now, we're talking here in the 1970s. The intelligence community is under investigation by congressional committees. This is in the wake of Watergate, which itself almost certainly appears to have been an intelligence operation in which the elder George Bush was deeply involved, what author Len Kolodny called a silent coup. And perhaps the most potentially significant of all of these investigations were the overlapping investigations, including the House Select Committee investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy, in which the elder George Bush appears to have been involved. He just couldn't seem to remember where he was and what he was doing that day, despite the fact that he was in Dallas, certainly the night before and probably that very day, and going to great lengths, as you point out in an entire chapter, to cover up where he was and what he was doing. So on November 1st, Warren Commission member Gerald Ford is president of the United States, and he makes a number of moves at this time, bringing in not only George H.W. Bush to become director of Central Intelligence at this sensitive time, but also two other names that figure prominently in the narratives of both Georges Bush, including and especially the younger, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. Introduce those names for us again, Russ.
Right. Rumsfeld was a very ambitious fellow who had a job in the Nixon administration. When Ford came in, he was made Ford's chief of staff, and his deputy was a young fellow named Dick Cheney. And after this, beer hall putsch, where they forced out a lot of the more moderate people, Rumsfeld became defense secretary, and Cheney moved up to be White House chief of staff. Interestingly, also, by the way, Kissinger was who had held both the positions of national security advisor and secretary of state, was pushed out of the national security advisor position in favor of the Air Force Lieutenant General Brent Scowcroft, another name of people very, very close with Poppy Bush, who would figure in later administrations. That is very, very interesting. Then you see the 1976 reelection campaign, and they forced Nelson Rockefeller, a moderate, off of the ticket in favor of Bob Dole. And Bush told the press that this whole thing was his own idea, which nobody believes. But what happened was they immediately lurched to the right. And U.S. policy, which had been one of detente and of openness and of outreach to America's Cold War enemies, suddenly moved to one that would be much more like the policy we would see under Ronald Reagan. And they would also shift away from intelligence assessments that indicated that the Soviets were not that great a threat, intelligence assessments that were in support of efforts to control the risk of nuclear war. And so all of these guys are critical players in this shift. This was something that appears to have been engineered again by this same military industrial complex that former General Dwight Eisenhower warned about. And Poppy Bush, again, a player in that whole thing. As CIA director, one of the first things he does is he puts in a second analytical team. They call it Team B, and it presents alternative scenarios to counteract the CIA analysts, who many of them feel are too soft and too moderate. So that's all going on. Very interesting, of course, because Rumsfeld and Cheney and Scowcroft would reappear when some years later when George H.W. becomes president, and then several of them would reappear years later again when George W. Bush becomes president.
Another
be definitive in steering American policy in recent years.
Another name we should introduce briefly at this point that will be familiar to younger listeners, well, older and younger listeners, but it was in the milieu of Team B, these scary storytellers about the former Soviet Union brought in by George H.W. Bush, that we see the political genesis of yet another of the players in W's administration, that is Paul Wolfowitz.
That's correct. And he was crucial to this because he was, sort of one of the great analytical figures, one of the great intellectuals, you might say, of the bunch, and very much comes into the formulation there. And so we were seeing the outline of what would come home to roost in 2000, and the same group, very, very eager to reassert American power on the world stage, very, very eager to seize these Middle East oil supplies. It's basically, what's interesting about it is it's the same group that worked with a cautious Poppy Bush, then went back in with a very much incautious W. They all had the same loyalties and tied into the same power circles, but it was really a matter of degree. And Poppy was always sort of reticent and cautious, as we know, and the Sun very much wasn't. And so this whole thing has been sort of misunderstood as them, the father and son, being very different people and having different philosophies. In fact, it was really just them having different sort of, you might say, tolerance for risk. But the ambitions of this group were always the same, and I think what's really important to point out, and I try to do this throughout Family of Secrets, is that none of the names we're talking about are the people who are ultimately really calling the shots. They've all got to answer to extremely powerful figures in the financial and industrial world who control those giant corporations and very often holding companies and linked into many different companies and banks or what have you, who are absolutely at the center of this entire global military, industrial, intelligence, petroleum, financial complex that back then was really running things and is still running things today.
Let's talk about the education of George Walker Bush. We've spoken about Yale and Skull and Bones. He went to Harvard Business School, and Harvard University as a business entity will come into the discussion later in connection with Harkin. But tell us about George W. Bush and Harvard Business School.
Well, I mean, you know, all of these things are a little bit hard to know exactly what went on. Certainly, he was no great shakes there. He didn't seem to take his schoolwork all that seriously. He very much wanted to play out this. He was already sort of practicing this kind of Texas thing, chewing tobacco, wearing cowboy boots and putting them up on the desk, you know, playing country music. You know, he was already sort of, you know, testing this whole thing. He told somebody, actually, I'm trying to remember what year it was, but I think it was right around, actually it was before he went to Harvard Business School. He already told somebody he wanted to run for public office. And so he was very aware that the West was on the rise, the power of the West, and that he was going to have to be much more effective than his father convincing people that he was a Western politician. So he was practicing that with, and also I think practicing how to kind of criticize those Eastern elites without people realizing that those Eastern elites were very much actually the same people as you were.
George Bush was not a particularly brilliant business student, and you point out that he was one of the very few people at Harvard Business School who managed to leave without a job. But he went back to what had been very fertile soil for his father and turned out to be for him, too. He goes back to Midland, Texas. Tell us about Arbusto Energy.
Right. Well, the father, you know, had gone out there, and then, see, they're very, very cognizant, as I think Barack Obama was too, of how you create a story that resonates well with people. A lot of people, when you talk about Obama and you try to stress that his establishment credentials, they'll say, but wait a minute, he was a neighborhood organizer. And then you say, well, of course. I mean, if you want to run for office, you have to do something like that. You've got to do something. Public service. I mean, he wasn't in the military, and so he needed something else. It's the same thing with the Bushes. They were very, very aware that they, you know, being born with the silver spoon and all that, they would be attacked for that. So the simple thing is to immerse yourself, get your hands dirty. And so Poppy had gone out to Texas, and they created this story about how he worked his way up from the bottom, which was not true. Very much, he was even flown out there on a family corporate jet. I mean, everything was made very easy for him. And the son was the same thing. So the son tells the story of how he, you know, headed out to West Texas and started his little tiny business in a broom closet sized room and just struggled from the bottom. But actually, I've studied the records of the company, and you just see one person after another marching in there, writing giant checks. In fact, one fellow came in and he flew in. He was James Baker's college roommate from Princeton, and he flew in and said, "Here's a check for $1 million." Now, keep in mind, this is in the early 70s, and that's still pretty big money, but back then, to just fly in with a check for $1 million into something, it was a total crapshoot. And then the lawyer, the outside lawyer, said to him, "Now I need to explain to you the risks involved." And he said, "Oh," according to the lawyer, this guy said, "Oh, don't bother. It's not my money."
Well, there you go. Nice work if you can get it. And he got it. However, Arbusto Energy didn't turn out to be a particularly profitable oil company. And again, I want to hearken, pun intended, back to some of our earlier discussions about Bush family business ventures, that they don't make a lot of sense from an overt business standpoint, but that when one dollies the camera out, as you have done so effectively in Family of Secrets, Russ Baker, what you see all over with business connections of really several generations of Bushes, you see intelligence connections, big time, as Dick Cheney would say. Arbusto didn't go too far. How about Spectrum 7? Tell us about that development.
Right. So what happened with Arbusto was Jim Bath comes in with some money, and as best as we can figure, anything that he had or that he was investing was on behalf of the Saudis. And so there's the very real possibility that the Saudis secretly put a substantial amount of money, not just into these things involving Bath, but actually into George W. And that would be very important in understanding his policies and his activities as president of the United States vis-a-vis the Saudis, Iraq, and so forth. Anyway, so Arbusto did not make money, was in trouble. Then along came a larger company called Spectrum 7 that bought it out. I encourage people to read the part in Family of Secrets about the figures behind Spectrum 7. They were Cincinnati businessmen, again, connected into Yale. They were involved later on with a very interesting reinsurance company with what appear to be intelligence ties. That's a very complex way of also involving large amounts of money. And then one of them was appointed when George W. Bush became president of the United States to the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, despite the fact he seemed to know nothing about any of that. And so that's Spectrum 7. They give him a nice salary. They've taken his money-losing company. Spectrum 7 isn't making any money. And so eventually it is swallowed up in turn by this company, Harkin Energy, which is by far the most fascinating.
Let's talk about the Quashes, Father William and Son Alan, and how they figure into this scenario.
Harkin Energy was a small and I think sort of regular, you might say, oil company. I flew out to Texas and spent some time in person with the man who had founded it, Phil Kendrick, and he took me through the whole history of the company. He grew up in the oil industry, and it was a viable oil company. But when the oil industry fell on hard times, he began looking for outside financing, and when he had a subsidiary in Asia, and as he was traveling around Asia, somehow the name Quasha had come up, and he'd heard about a man named Quasha, an American who'd lived most of his adult life in the Philippines, and somebody had told him how Quasha was thought of to be some sort of a front for the vast billions of the Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos, who, of course, those were ill-gotten gains of money transferred from the impoverished people of the Philippines, as well, of course, American tax dollars and so forth, to Marcos. In any case, that was the father, Quasha. Now, along comes a broker from the East Coast, contacts Kendrick and says, "I've got somebody who'd like to invest in your company." And he says, "Great." And he says, "Yeah, this guy, Alan Quasha." And so this turns out to be the son of the man he'd already heard about in connection with Marcos. Quasha begins taking a position in the company, takes in more and more. The money comes in indirectly from various Caribbean entities, some of it blocks of stock, I think, in the names of, I have to check again, but I believe the mother and the father, not clear where they would get that kind of money. themselves. But in any case, they eventually basically oust Kendrick from his own company, and they go about announcing that the company is doing really, really badly. The stock plummets. They're able to buy more stock at a fraction of the price, and he's out. And then the company begins doing all kinds of interesting things. It makes a deal with George Soros. He had a bunch of loose oil properties. It takes those over, puts him into the company. And then a few years later, it takes over Spectrum 7 and brings George W. Bush into the company. This is in the late 80s as Marcos is battling for survival in the Philippines. And Bush's father is vice president of the United States. And so they bring him in, they rescue Bush, they give him the best salary he's ever had, and they put him on the board, and they basically require him to do almost nothing at all. And he just takes off and essentially moves to Washington, where he ends up being key senior staff on his father's presidential campaign. And so this Harkin Energy Company is very much set with tremendous influence with that family. And Harkin's quite interesting because, and we can only scratch the surface here, but in Family of Secrets, I have a whole chapter on it where I go into all the people who are involved. And again, we find Saudis, we find people with connections to the Shah of Iran, of Ferdinand Marcos, of the South African apartheid regime, the white supremacist, the exclusive elite of South Africa, a Swiss bank, on and on and on. And many of these figures having intelligence connections, oil connections, connections to dictators. And it's an intriguing outfit. And then finally, as the company needs still more money, Harvard University comes in. And that is probably the most interesting of all, and that's why I devote, I'd say, almost half the chapter to Harvard. And what was it doing in this fascinating entity?
Just very briefly, Robert Stone, the head of the Harvard Management Corporation, another member of the old boy network of the Eastern financial and industrial establishment. Encapsulate him to the extent that one could, perhaps.
Well, I mean, the Boston Globe, the main newspaper in Boston, had looked at this thing. Time Magazine, Wall Street Journal, they all looked at Harkin and collectively adjudged it to be this one of the strangest things they'd ever seen. Didn't seem to make any money, didn't make any sense, yet exploded. It went from just a few million to something like a billion in revenues, and the question was, what is this thing? It was gobbling up all kinds of companies and so forth, but it wasn't clear what it was exactly and why it very seldom made any money for the outside shareholders. Just very mysterious. And it also, by the way, had a lot of things that we would later see with Enron, these complex separate related partnerships where they were moving profits and losses conveniently for the various entities and partners. But in any case, Robert Stone, he was the reason his name comes up is looking at why Harvard University made the largest investment it ever made in direct private equity investment into this tiny little and unprofitable company. They were trying to figure that out, and they got as far as to the fact that the head of the Harvard Board of Overseers, probably the single most powerful person at Harvard, a man named Robert Stone, might have had something to do with that. Now, he denied it in a very cagey way, and I do a lot of, in Family of Secrets, a lot of assessing the splitting of hairs, the parsing of words, where people are not explicitly lying, but they're being very careful in the way that they couch things to make it hard for us to figure out what's really going on. Robert Stone made it sound like he was nothing. That was the end of the reporting by the mainstream media, but I continued looking, and basically what I discovered was that Robert Stone had an intelligence background himself. And this went all the way back to World War II when I discovered he had worked for General Douglas MacArthur, as I think we pointed out in an earlier episode, did Poppy Bush when he worked in basically naval intelligence during the war. And so Robert Stone was also in the same group, as was William Quasha. So Stone and Quasha both worked on General MacArthur's staff at the same time. General MacArthur running his own intelligence operation in the Pacific and keeping the OSS largely out. So all these people knew each other. And what I finally discovered that seemed to connect all of these things was gold.
One of the things you speculate about, and by the way, veteran and regular listeners of the program are very familiar with Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagraves. I've read at length from the book and have interviewed both of them on the air. You speculate that, and it is a speculative element, we should stress that, is that the Harkin may have been used as, you go into Harkin as apparently a money laundering vehicle at great length, but one of the speculative elements is that it may have been used to launder some of the gold that was left by General Yamashita, and certainly Bob Stone had a tremendous involvement with the gold industry.
Right. There's a lot of sense that there was gold. I mean, there is gold in the world. And when there's a war, the victors often take the gold. And we do know that the Japanese took gold. We know that the Nazis took gold. And the Japanese took the gold, which, was a mainstay of the treasury of so many of these countries that they invaded, and that supposedly moved it. They wanted to keep it somewhere safe, and that the Philippines was where they kept it. There also, the Philippines was a very important gold mining country in its own right. And so there was this reputed, several different sources of vast amounts of gold. And of course, if you have vast amounts of gold, as they say, he who has the gold rules. So the gold is a very important means, again, potentially of funding unauthorized covert operations. And this is a consistent theme in Family of Secrets, the idea that the intelligence apparatus writ large is not under control, and it does whatever it wants, or more appropriately, I should say, it does whatever people in the private sector who have influence inside it want it to do. And the problem is, how do you fund these things? And so you can't fund them openly, you can't fund them using tax dollars, and you can't have the funds being traceable. Well, one of the best ways to do that is in the form of things like gold, which is not easily traceable, and especially if you've got a whole lot of gold that nobody knows even exists. It could be an endless store for your budget. And so I do find gold patterns, and we even see with the junior Quasha years later that he ends up on the board of, I can't remember, it was American Express Gold Fund, and we find Stone's connections to gold. We find gold running through all this, and we find also that some of the key investors in Harkin are people from South Africa, again, the number one supplier of gold in the world. And so it's gold, gold, gold all the time. And one wonders whether that was not the whole purpose of the entity in the first place.
You mentioned William Quasha briefly, known to this audience as is the lawyer for the Philippine branch of the Nguyen Bank, another of these drugs and intelligence connected banks that we've spoken about. In connection with this networking that we've been talking about, in a sense, we're almost looking at the Gold Boys Network.
By the way, another guy who was involved with Quasha, a fellow named Hassan Namazi. Listeners may want to go to our website, whowhatwhy.com, where we are trying to build a journalistic entity to continue looking into all these things and tie them into what's happening right now. And there you'll see an article along the right side of the homepage about Hassan Namazi and about Quasha and some of their other businesses, because they went on to take over a name brand on Wall Street that had sort of fallen on hard times. And then, according to the people who previously ran that company, strange things began to happen there. Several years later, Hassan Namazi becomes described as the key foreign policy advisor to Hillary Clinton. Quasha, obviously close with George W. Bush. And then you see Namazi not very long ago arrested and now very likely going to do some extensive time for millions and millions of dollars of bank fraud. How it is that somebody like that could be involved in this entanglement with all of these banks and so much money and then himself need to defraud a bank is hard to figure, but that's the way life goes sometimes.
Yeah, you also, one of the things recalling briefly, because we did touch on it last interview, that in the 70s when Poppy is for a time ascended at CIA and when this whole BC CCI milieu is percolating around. They tarred Burt Lance and Jimmy Carter with some of these same scandal brushes as well. Back to Harvard Management Corporation, Bob Stone and Harkin Energy. And we've got about a little over 3 minutes left on this side. In fact, we've got a little over 3 minutes. Let's perhaps introduce how Harkin Energy is. Well, you know what? Let's encapsulate Bahrain, and then in our next interview, we'll talk about the Texas Rangers and how Bush, Bush the Younger, ascends the political stage. The Bahrain imbroglio. Can you encapsulate that? Given we've only got a couple of minutes.
Sure. I mean, basically, Harkin was given got an exclusive contract to drill for what was believed to be a significant amount of oil off of Bahrain. And this was, instead of going with the big oil companies that made bids, they said they went with Harkin because they didn't have any experience, and therefore they felt that they might be more focused on this project, one of the strangest explanations I've ever heard in business. There was no oil found there, and then in a complicated series of things, George W. Bush appears to have benefited or was alleged to have benefited from inside information pertaining to Harkin stock, pertaining to Bahrain, whether there was oil there or not, and that all this was part of his amassing his present fortune.
And ultimately, the stock that George Bush held in Harkin Energy, which may very well have been the focal point of the fulcrum of an illegal transaction, but this ultimately was parlayed into a very successful and politically marketable part ownership of the Texas Rangers. Maybe we can introduce that, and then we'll develop that further as we really get into George W. Bush ascendant.
Sure. Well, I mean, Texas Rangers deal was crucial because he would have had a hard time, George W. Bush, being elected governor and then president on the strength of having run two failed oil companies and then having them taken over by a third company that itself didn't really make any money, and that was so incredibly strange. I don't know if I mentioned Harkin also had Saudis in there with big blocks of the stock, and so that company couldn't have borne scrutiny either, and so he needed something else on his resume after that, something more successful, something more all-American, and that is the Texas Rangers, which we can go into further.
Yep. We have been speaking with Russ Baker, the author of Family of Secrets, subtitled The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Russ, tell us about where people can get the website and or get the book, and also your website.
Family of Secrets should be in local bookstores. If it's not, you can ask them to carry it, and they will. And it's also available online, Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and so forth. I try to support independent bookstores. And you can go to our website, familyofsecrets.com, click there and order through that. Then our website, whowhatwhy.com, whowhatwhy.com. That's our new nonprofit investigative reporting site, publicly supported. And go there and sign up for our mailing list.
And let me also stress to the listening audience, we are concluding the fifth interview that we've done. We have one more that we're going to be doing. I do think that we could fairly say, Russ Baker, that we have scratched the surface of Family of Secrets, but we really haven't done any more than that. And in 6 hours, which we will have in the can by the time we're finished, is a lot of interviewing about a book. But then the book itself is about 600 pages, and the footnotes go on and on and on and on. But so if listeners are wondering, well, what else is there? There's plenty else there, because really, we've not only we've scratched the surface, but no more than that. But many of the things that we've touched on, for example, the Watergate affair, the entire concatenation, the entire construction that George H.W. Bush put together to cover his presence in Dallas, are dealt with at length and in detail and present a very compelling narrative. A lot of this, though, Russ Baker, I don't think is easy to talk about on the radio, because in order to understand it, you have to get into the detail. But you have certainly done that in Family of Secrets, and we'll get into some more of that in our next interview. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 715, interview with Russ Baker. This is being recorded on June 6th of the year 2010. For Russ Baker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.